gentlemen, welcome to the main event.
Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station.
Well, let's get going here. Yeah. Well, that's a little too much audio. Terrible Tommy here, right here in the bunker. Yeah, I tend to use too much audio. Yeah. Well, guess what? Bow your heads and cry. I've told you many times that I think sometimes God hates black people. Well, here's a story that may prove it. The pastor gives eulogy at his church and then dies in front of everyone. Black minister, Reverend Darrell Edwards, passed away while eulogizing a member of his church, Sally Bland, in front of nearly 200 observers at the Fannin Street United Baptist Church, Methodist Church. Edwards collapsed. He was sharing stories and scripture to those who had gathered at the 10 a.m. service. He even mentioned that someone or anyone could be called to heaven at any time. And he was. He collapsed right there and there, which proves maybe God hates black preachers. Oh boy, here's the latest in revisionist black history. DNA evidence proves that the first people in China were black. I don't think you better try to sell that to the Chinese and those naughty Israelis. Israel admits to forcibly injecting black immigrants with birth control. Well, that's a good idea. That's a hell of a good idea. Well, listen to what they're saying about the Reverend Al Sharpton today, boys. Yeah.
You know, when you got a fuse that's already lit, you don't need to add no more fire to it. Knowing their history, it's about money.
No justice! No justice! No justice!
No peace! Go, Reverend Al. You tell him.
Who is Al Sharpton?
Yeah.
Baptist minister? Television personality? Charlatan? Race baiter? Project Veritas decided to investigate Sharpton and talk with the people he claims he is trying to help. Their verdict? Sharpton is more sinner than saint.
I'm minding my business. Please just leave me alone. I told you the last time. Please leave me alone. Put your hand behind your back. You can't breathe.
Justice for every God.
Huh? Who's your father?
Yeah, that was my father. I'm his oldest child.
So what, you think Al Sharpton is kind of like a crook in a sense? Like, you think he's like...
Human. Al Sharpton seems to always find a cause, and lately he has shown up at a lot of funerals. In fact, his organization NAN, the National Action Network, often pays for them. It affords him center stage in the circus of a controversy.
We got to be here for the long haul. Michael Brown does not want to be remembered for riots.
As Ferguson, Missouri heated up in the days after Michael Brown's death, Sharpton met with community leaders. Bishop Calvin Scott was troubled by what he heard.
I frankly was in one of his, more than one, a couple of meetings, two or three meetings that he was in, and I think to some degree he sort of incites people for the wrong reason. You know, I'm in the gathering, he's got them all fired up, but I just sense that this is not the way you want to go. You know, when you got a fuse that's already lit, you don't need to add no more fire to it.
2 years ago, Sharpton took on the cause of Trayvon Martin. Daryl Parks is a lawyer who represented both the families of Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown. He has known and worked with Sharpton for years.
But Sharpton is all about his money.
And there may be a little truth to that. But I'll admit that. That's the only truth, the only I'll admit to.
The daughter of Eric Gardner, the religious community in Ferguson, and a prominent lawyer for the Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown families, believe they know who the real Al Sharpton is, and they are not alone.
I just try to keep my money away from him.
I don't blame you.
Yeah.
I certainly don't blame you. You got the administrative fees and the administrative costs. You got all this costs. By the end of the day, you got maybe 10% of what you donated actually really going and hitting the streets. Sharpton's going to be all right. He's been all right forever. He knows how to make money and get money. They're shakedown guys.
Yeah.
You know, that's totally what it is. They're shakedown.
Earlier this month, we found a photo of Al Sharpton on the Trayvon Martin Foundation website.
One concern about this. I saw on your website Nan, the Sharpton thing.
That's a sore subject with us right now.
When asked if Sharpton would be attending a fundraising dinner, the president and executive director of the Trayvon Martin Foundation, Troy Wright, seemed to suggest that the good Reverend Al wasn't welcome.
Oh, really? You're not a big Sharpton fan? How tied are you in with...
Well, I'll give you an example. He won't be at the dinner on Sunday.
That's by design?
Just a decision made that he won't be at the dinner Sunday.
Nah, I hear you.
I'll just leave it at that.
Sharpton wasn't at the dinner, but Project Veritas was. Tickets cost $75. When we talked with Trayvon's father, Tracy, we asked him where the money would be going.
Promise me this money's not going to end up without you.
Oh, no.
Have you met him?
Who? Sharpton? Sharpton, I've met him. You know, everybody has their own different opinions, you know. I mean,
at the dinner, Troy Wright again distanced the foundation away from Sharpton.
Still concerned with Sharpton. I wouldn't worry about that. I mean, I guarantee you, his involvement, he has no real involvement in the foundation. There's no connection there.
The only thing is that they were proud to put it on their website. Do you want to take this organization away from Sharpton? Like, is it a different direction? Like, do you want to separate yourself? Are you willing to do that?
What Troy Wright was willing to do was to remove any and all images of Sharpton and Nan from the Foundation website, just days after we spoke to him.
Eric Gardner!
Eric Gardner!
Eric Gardner!
Erica Gardner, the daughter of Eric Gardner, has also severed ties with Al Sharpton, saying his organization has tried to control her actions and profit from her father's death.
This lady, Cynthia
Davis, she's the chapter out here for the National Action Network.
Cynthia Davis called you and told you, oh, you need to put the logos.
She told me to my face, too.
Cynthia Davis is one of Al Sharpton's top lieutenants.
She started attacking me as far as, oh, you! I think that you got this flyer out. How come you ain't add the logo?
So they want their logo on your flyers?
On my flyers.
But it's not about them. It's about your dad.
Exactly. Instead of me, he wants his face in front of him.
Wants his group, which is what?
For the funeral. She's trying to make me feel like I'm old.
Ooh, hold on. How come I ain't noticed?
Because they need them.
When I first came out to
promote
for my
But it shouldn't be about money.
Ask me information.
Are you welcome to America?
So what you think, Al Sharpton? Is kind of like a crook in a sense. Like you think he's like he's about his money with you.
Months after Michael Brown's death and the riots that followed, Ferguson is still struggling to rebuild buildings and trust.
Do you think that Al Sharpton exploited Michael Brown's case for his own profit?
In my opinion, yes, I believe he did. I think that as he came into the community, rather than try to establish a common conversation, it was more of a baiting situation to where he was divisive of people. Instead of bringing us together, I think he was drawing us apart.
Well, I'm not quite sure of what Al Sharpton did. I know he came and he spoke a couple of times. I don't really know what he did.
One of the things Sharpton did was to use the Michael Brown controversy to raise money for Nan.
frankly, if your motive is to help and be a source of resolve, money should not be the primary.
Right.
It should not be. And that's a question mark. And you're not the first person to raise that question.
Yeah.
I can't believe it.
That even mentioned that they know
I
the
am shot
of
to
an
my
Al
shoes.
Organization such as him. And they emphatically stated that it to them, for them, knowing their history, it's about money.
There you go. Poor Reverend R. Poor Reverend. Reverend Al, keep going, man. You're doing good. From the way I look at it, from my side, you do a great job of screwing up the opposition. I wish we had a hell of a lot more Reverend Al's around. Yeah. He's got the blacks split up 16 ways. The next question, is he going to come to Chicago or go to Chicago to get involved in the runoff election coming up there where it's the black against the Mexican? That's going to be interesting. Maybe the blacks will tell him to stay away. Well, let's see here. A recent investigation completed by the Equal Justice, number one, it's flawed, anything with equal in it, Equal Justice Initiative over the course of several years uncovered disturbing details about racial violence and lynchings in the South between 1877 and 1950. Of course, they failed to cover the West, which was primarily vigilante justice in the mining and logging camps, which was almost all white lynchings of the same number. The inventory revealed a bloody history of racial violence and was much more extensive and brutal than anyone imagined. Southern states are known for their history of racial violence, but as the second piece in a series of reports that is taking a closer look at the history of the United States, tracing a line from slavery to mass incarceration and blah, 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 blah. Well, my question is always this. You know, the white working class didn't ask for Negroes to come to North America. Didn't appeal to their congressmen to bring them here or anything else. They didn't want it because they knew equality was a sham and so there's going to be violence. It was always for the best interest of the wealthy class that Negroes were brought here, knowing that their very presence would forever lead to problems and violence and so forth. But the wealthy class said, we don't care. We want cheap labor no matter how we can get it. So we're going to bring the Negroes here no matter what you want. So the obvious occurred. Two unequal races, side by side, are going to fight. There's going to be violence. There's going to be killing. And it's going to go on till the end of time. But no one wants to confront the basis, greed, by the small percentage of the rich of our race. Yep. Along with the usual suspects of Jews and others that always will take advantage of any situation like that. But guess who gets blamed for the racial violence? Even though a lot of times they participate in it, but millions of white people are blamed for it. It's your fault because biologically you're two separate races and you're not equal and you'll never get along perfectly. You'll never integrate to the point where you think you should integrate or anything like that. So every time they start crying about lynching, these things come up in my mind. You wouldn't have any lynching if you just stayed in Africa or stayed wherever you were. And if it had been up to the working class whites of this country, even in the beginnings of this country, there would have been no blacks in this country because they had nothing to gain. Only the rich, the same people in power then, are the same people who are in power now. Predatory capitalist, greedy people of our race. But they shove off, they write tons of books blaming the white working class, you know. They always want to get out of it. Oh, we always loved the blacks. Yeah, it made you billions of dollars. That's why you loved the blacks. Well, anyhow, that's something I was thinking about. I think about it all the time. Every time they cry racism, I say, well, racism only exists when the two races are jammed together. When I was a child, there were no blacks around, so there was no racism. I don't remember ever hearing anybody say nigger when I was a kid, because there weren't any around. It didn't even come to your mind. So when they say, well, you're wrong on this argument. Oh, yeah? Oh, yeah, we all understand now, because we've been brainwashed by the rich and the powerful so they can make a lot more money, that there's equality. We have to strive continually for equality, something that's never, ever, ever going to happen. It's impossible. Oh, boy. And of course, you want your rights. Always asking, I want my rights, I insist on my rights, but you never can have the rights. You can only have the privileges if the rich, the oligarchs, the predatory capitalists want you to have rights. Then it's a privilege. So all those people out there, probably most of your neighbors that have been mesmerized into believing the crap, they're out there. They're not going to change. They're going to die pretending, at least, they believe in racial equality. The bulk of the third world have perfect equality. Everybody's dirt poor and have no expectations of getting any better. Still, it's a small percentage at the top who control these societies, but billions of people in the third world are equal. They're hungry, they're poor, they're diseased, and they have no future. There's equality. That's the way it ends up. Well, I have a new book of poetry. Well, I've had it for quite a while. Doom Goddess sent it to me. I thought we'd go through it a little bit from time to time, and you can guess who the subject matter is about. The first poem is entitled My Start. I'm fortune's favorite from birth, because of all the spots on earth, 'twas Brownow fate decreed should be the scene of my nativity. It's Austrian, you'll understand, but yet upon the borderland, I dreamt of Auschwitz in my youth, before I cut my earliest tooth. My father was a man deserving, whose métier was civil serving. He wished that I, for my vocation, should choose a similar occupation. But not at all, though stout my nerve is, it jibed at thoughts of civil service. And I decided that at least I'd be an abbot or a priest. But my respected parents said, quote, you're far too big a dunderhead, unquote. And I replied in accents fainter, well then I'd rather be a painter. My soul and happiness e'er gushes at thoughts of paint pots and brushes, and naught on earth would make me gladder than climbing up and down a ladder. A painter and decorator, no human lot can e'er be greater. So filled with dreams and trestle boards, I made my way to Vienna wards. Okay, there you go. That's the first one. We got a lot of them, but I'll just intersperse them with the show now and then, okay? Well, let's tune into that rogue progressive who don't like racists, but he says a lot of other things that aren't not too bad. So come on, Mikey, let's hear it.
Today in history, yes indeed, Lee in New York City sent this to me. In 1993, this was the day the bomb in the garage under the World Trade Center. Remember that? Lee writes, I was working across the street in the World Financial Center that day. What did we learn? We learned that to limit access to the parking garage and check vehicles. We learned to add short pillars around the World Trade Center to prevent vehicles from driving up to the towers or onto Austin Tobin Plaza. What did we not learn? Replacing first responder communications equipment via a no-bid contract was not successful, and the old equipment was returned to use. Moving the mayor's emergency command center to 7 World Trade Center was not the best location. Thank you, Mayor Giuliani, Lee writes, for both of those. Do you love New York City? What do terrorists know? If the front door was unlocked and you entered that way, look for a different way in when you see the owner putting multiple locks on only the front door. And now the unfunded TSA may not be checking for too many matches, unidentified liquids, pocket knives, shoe bombs, underwear bombs, or any of the other multitude of items that only terrorists have used for mass murder in the past. Republicans do not have to make Americans dumber. We are already there. We are already there. Lee in New York City. Did we get a resolution of the funding of Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security yet? No? Let me show you the. You got that video? You think we can play the video tonight? Or okay. I have a piece of video for you here. We're going to try to play it for you. It's John Boehner today. He was asked a question about funding Department of Homeland Security. That's the general, what the general question was. And the reporter asked him, what are you going to do when the Senate bill comes back to you for consideration in the House? And he tried to say that, you know, we don't know what's in the Senate bill. We're waiting for the Senate to do something, which is not true. Boehner knows exactly what's in the bill. He knows what's coming back. This is just his way of being the typical bastard that he is.
Well, that's not the one I wanted to play. Hold on here. Let me look around here. Got things a little bit screwed up as usual.
This is comes under the heading of really typically U.S. foreign policy. Okay, here we go. This is from the Business Insider. In March, Barack Obama reportedly offered Israel bunker buster bombs and other advanced.
All you need is love.
Thanks, Will. Check him out. Hempmatters.net. Hempmatters.net. .net, okay? This is comes under the heading of really typically U.S. foreign policy. Okay, here we go. This is from the Business Insider. In March, Barack Obama reportedly offered Israel bunker buster bombs and other advanced weapons in exchange for postponing an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. At the time, the White House denied that any such agreement was proposed or reached. Bunker busters are essential for an attack on Iran's underground nuclear facilities. This week, the U.S. Department of Defense notified Congress of a $647 million agreement to provide the Israel Air Force with 10,000 bombs, more than half of which are bunker busters, along with 7,000 Joint Direct Attack Munitions, JDAM tail kits, which convert unguided freefall bombs into satellite-guided smart weapons. Haaretz reported that the deal would serve, quote, to renew the inventory of the Israel Defense Forces following the massive bombings in Gaza during Operation Pillar of Defense, end quote. Blah, 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 blah. Last year, the New York Times reported that the United States refrained from sending these munitions because, quote, there were deep concerns in the United States that supplying these bombs to Israel might be viewed as having tacitly endorsed an attack on Iran. Okay, that is that's the sale of 5,000 bunker buster bombs and 5,000 other bombs to Israel. And then there's this. The U.S. Pentagon said it plans a large arms sale to Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates worth $10 billion. The weapons include bunker buster bombs and air-launched cruise missiles that can hit targets from a long distance, according to the French news agency. The weapons will be used on U.S.-made F-15 and F-16 fighter jets, according to the U.S. Defense Security Cooperation Agency. Now, this is not news from last week. I mean, this is so typical. The Saudis, who produced 19 people who came to this country and murdered 3,000 people on American soil with the help of the Bush administration. The Israelis are threatening to start World War III, or as the Christian crazy people call it, the rapture. So what does the United States do? We give the Saudis, or we sell them, $11 billion worth of cruise missiles and these enormous bunker buster bombs. And to Israel, we give 5,000 so-called bunker buster bombs and the JDAM kits in order to change free-falling bombs into more or less satellite-guided missiles. But remember, we're a Christian nation. We're just chock-a-block with Christians. So we're going to sell weapons of mass destruction to the Jews and the Muslims. I mean, is this not... Oh, never mind. Never mind. Good Lord. Oh, and Pat Robertson now is worried about the health care supply. Yeah, the health care supply. After he said he was now a Main Street pundit, Robertson, according to Crooks and Liars, Carolee over at Crooks and Liars had this up, he took after liberals for their nerve to want health care for everyone. Right Wing Watch caught him ranting at... Woo! I'm sorry. Constitutional duties. On top of all that, the United States is accusing Israel yesterday of distorting the U.S. position in the Iran nuclear talks through selective leaks. Oh, a leaker, arrest him, which is intensifying tensions before this visit to the U.S. Parliament by Israel's prime minister. White House spokesman Josh Earnest told reporters, quote, we see that there is a continued practice of cherry-picking specific pieces of information and using them out of context to distort the negotiating position of the United States. He went on to say there is no question that some of the things that the Israelis have said in characterizing our negotiating position have not been accurate. Well, Josh, why don't you just come out? I know you can't because, you know, you're all into diplomacy and stuff. Why don't you just come out and say the Israelis are goddamn liars? See, what the Israeli wants, what the Israelis want is the same thing that Boehner and the rest of these war dogs in this country want. They want us to attack Iran. Yes. And I'm sure Boehner and McConnell and the rest of these Likudnik bastards in the U.S. Congress, along with Mr. Netanyahu, would be very, very happy if we attacked with, you know, small nuclear bombs. And short of that, Bunker Busters, which are what, 5,000 pound, or is it 10,000, or is it 100,000? Who cares? This is what Netanyahu wants, and that's why he's coming to the U.S. Parliament. He is coming to tell them that they are cowardly betrayers of Judeo-Christian values if the United States doesn't attack now, now, Torah, 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 so to speak. Isn't that interesting? In Japanese, though, they leave the H off. Josh Earnest was discussing a New York Times report that cited Israeli officials saying the United States had limited what it was sharing with them about the talks. Oh, so that's it. Netanyahu got his bloomers in a twist because, first of all, he's not in on the talks, and secondly, because the U.S. is not sharing everything with him. Oh, darn. Well, no wonder he's pissed off. And a European official said that he, Netanyahu, had been warned by Washington to be careful what he shared for fear of it being selectively leaked. Are you kidding me? The Israelis would betray the United States before you could say Yom Kippur. I mean, kaboom! Are you kidding me? The Israelis have one, and only one loyalty, and that's to themselves. And do we fault them for that? Not if we're sane. That's what the United States should do. That's what the Russians are doing. That's what everybody should do. I am loyal to my tribe, my little piece of planet Earth, and I'll goddamn kill you if you come near it. Ooh, now we're talking. Now we're talking. Now, this rare U.S. criticism is the way Reuters news agency puts it, rare U.S. No, singular, I would say. U.S. criticism, this occurs, of course, ahead of that speech that Netanyahu is going to give at the U.S. Congress on March 3rd. Oh, that's going to be fun. Isn't that going to be fun? What do you think? Let's see, March 3rd. By March, is that a Monday? By March 10th, we'll probably be in a full-blown war. You watch. Anyway, Bonner's invitation has caused some tension in Israel and the U.S. with people who have a little bit of sanity left, not much, but just shreds. People saying that Netanyahu, who's a hawk on Iran, by being a hawk, that means a murderer, a killer, someone who wants to nuke them. That Netanyahu is working with Republicans to demonstrate their opposition to Barack Obama's Iran policy. Now, this is something I think relatively new. I realize that the Brits and the U.S. and the Canadians all get together and talk things over and decide who they're going to terrorize next. But to have the prime minister of a foreign country taking on full speed ahead the foreign policy of a president of another country. Now, I realize Netanyahu has total disdain for every other government on earth. None of them mean anything to him. The only thing that means anything to him is the Likud party and his role in it. So, even realizing that, the breach of what? Protocol? In international relations? The leader of a country is coming to address the parliament of another country and is not even going to meet with the leader of that country, who doesn't want to meet with his ass anyway, for obvious reasons, and trying to influence that parliament, our Congress, our useless, filthy Congress, to go ahead and make war. To hell with the President of the United States. Go ahead. Authorize an attack on Iran. This is what Netanyahu wants. And this is what Netanyahu will probably get. Because don't forget, when Netanyahu addresses all or part of the U.S. Congress, every time he burps, belches, or farts, they will stand up and applaud him. because he's a Jew, and Jesus was a Jew, and the Jews have got to reestablish Israel before Jesus comes back. And then they'll kill all the Jews, of course, because the Jews won't convert and recognize the Messiah as the Christians want them to. So the Christians, led by Pastor Hagee, will begin cutting throats. You think the 21, and I'm not trying to be funny here, you think the 21 that were executed on the shores of Libya earlier this week or whenever it was, you think that was a bloodbath? Where do the Christians go after the Jews? It's been done before, you know. This is also Netanyahu's way of establishing those political links to the Republican Party, regardless of Israeli-U.S. relations. Well, we're going to war. Now, if you don't like that, I suggest you get the hell out of the country, because, brothers and sisters, if you listen, you can hear the drums a-beating. We're going to war. We'll be right back.
Well, we had a little rough spot there, but we made it through. And I think that information was important. And about these warmongering bastards that are running the show. And essentially, that's what happens when their premier comes to the Congress and talks. He's coming to give orders of what he wants. For the Jews, the only hope for any kind of peace around there is for him to lose the election and get somebody that's more moderate. But I don't think that's going to happen. Don't think that's going to happen. Incidentally, as a side issue, I've compiled information on the 2016 presidential election. And my sources, and other than what the right-wing nuts say, I do have my sources, and that is that Hillary will win the nomination, but she will not win the presidency. Now, that seems a little far-fetched, doesn't it? But that's what my people tell me, okay? Based on some sound scientific logic. Okay, Jimmy Hightower, you populist fool, go on with your spiel. What's going on at your end?
Come one, come all. Step right up and buy your ticket for a ride on the splendiferous, phantasmagoric, supersonic, miraculous, trans-Pacific partnership. TPP is not some sort of futuristic flying machine, but yet another global trade scam coming at us like a volcanic eruption straight out of hell. This thing is a partnership of, by, and for global corporations, similar to NAFTA, only much, much, much bigger and far more destructive, both to the middle class and to our people's sovereignty. Negotiating in strict secrecy during the past 7 years, a cabal of the Obama White House and corporate lobbyists are now ready to spring it on us, and Republican leaders intend to ram it into law before we, the people, can get a whiff of its anti-democratic stench. Indeed, to perfume it, they've already begun a PR campaign touting TPP as the long-sought wonder cure for America's downtrodden working class. For example, such odd bedfellow boosters as Secretary of State John Kerry and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce both exclaim that the 12-nation scheme will, quote, support 650,000 new jobs. Wow, really? No. In January, the Washington Post fact-checker column dug into that number and found that it was miscalculated and misleading. In fact, the columnist found that, quote, the correct number is zero. He also pointed out that even if 650,000 jobs were created, that's not even a drop in the bucket, for it would increase U.S. employment by less than one-half of 1%. This is Jim Hightower saying, be alert, friends, for the TPP gang will try to dazzle us with hokey numbers and neon lies They turn our future well-being over to global corporations.
Thank you,
get
Jimmy.
Get information and get involved. Go to citizen.org/trade.
Thank you for watching those goddamn predatory capitalists. I bet you're not going to hear a lot of this stuff on VNN or Stormfront. Yeah, right. Keep them dumb. Well, let's fill out the rest of the show with the man called Lucy. Up until now, we know how Roessler, living down in Switzerland, got various people together and set up a spy ring in the chancellery in Germany with 10 high-ranking officers involved in his spy ring, and only a couple of them had access to the telex, which I hadn't said anything about that. So anyhow, he's now got it full gone. He's been supplying information to the Western countries that Hitler's coming and you better start doing something, and they didn't pay any attention to him, and so Hitler overrun him, and they paid the price. So now we go a little farther into it. Without mentioning him by name, he had spoken of Roessler to the group's leader, who did not seem very impressed. He was willing to pass the intelligence along, but could not answer for the reactions of the MGB, the center, as it was known familiarly to the Soviet spies. The Minister of State Security in Moscow, that directed the activities of all the delegations abroad. For security reasons, Roessler would never meet Schneider's group leader, nor even know his name. Similarly, Geneva would know nothing of Roessler. Between Geneva and Lucerne, there would be two go-betweens, two people who would pass on Roessler's information. If the Swiss or the Germans arrested them, neither the cell in Geneva nor Roessler should suffer. For these intermediaries always carried a capsule containing cyanide, which they would swallow in the situation if it grew serious enough. The first go-between would be Schneider himself, and the second would be the friend of his, Rachel Dubendorfer. If anything happened to him, she would take his place as the first intermediary. Like Schneider, Rachel was employed by the International Labor Office. She lived in Geneva with her daughter, Tamara. Although of Balkan origin, she had a Swiss passport. Just before the war, she had gone through a white marriage with a Swiss. This was a fairly common practice at the time. One had been highly profitable to a number of Swiss citizens who had sold their names and the security that they brought with them. In fact, Rachel was living with her lover, Paul Boscher, as an ex-German minister, also an emigre and a communist. "Is everything clear then?" Schneider asked. "You give me your intelligence, I pass it on to Rachel, who takes it to Geneva. Two more things. If Moscow accepts your cooperation, you will be paid, and you must change your name. We all have aliases. I'm Taylor. Rachel Dubendorfer is Sissy. You will be known as Lucy." Thus, in the spring of 1941, Rudolf Roessler, a liberal Protestant German from a respectable conservative upper middle class Bavarian background, a man who, despite his immigration, had retained the class consciousness of his caste, became out of hatred of Nazism a Soviet secret agent. He did so with the blessings of the Bureau, HA, and Masson, who agreed on the condition that he continue to work for Switzerland and supply intelligence that would be useful to the Western Allies. Fate, which played so great a role throughout this extraordinary affair, was soon to appear once more in a strangely ironic way. Roessler, though frail in appearance, had boundless vitality and slept no more than 3 hours a night. In spite of all his various secret activities, he managed to continue with his writing, as always, under his pen name, R.A. Hermes. At the beginning of 41, he published a remarkable analysis of the strategy of the Wehrmacht. It was called Theaters of War and Conditions for Their Conduct. A work of 90 close printed pages as illustrations for his little book. He needed 12 specifically drawn maps showing the various movements of the German army. So he called on the services of the best geographical firm in Switzerland, the Geopresse in Geneva. Its director came to Lucerne to discuss Roessler's sketches with him in person. Roessler was never to know that he had opposite him the most important Soviet spy in the world. Nor did he realize that this thick-set businessman who spoke six languages and was so adept at translating his ideas into concrete form was the head of the Russian spy network in Switzerland, Alexander Rado, his new boss. Chapter 6. More than any of the traditional covers used by spies, it was his natural gaiety that protected Alexander Rodolphe, known as Rado, to his friends. It was far more difficult to imagine this happy extrovert engaged in plotting and spying than to picture him pursuing a girl or savoring a good meal. Yet Rado was a master spy, a colonel in the Red Army, born in Hungary but trained in a very special school, Sekhyadna, the training center of the Soviet espionage service just outside Moscow. Prior to that, Rado had worked for the Comintern, fomenting revolutions throughout Europe, in his own country, in Czechoslovakia, Poland, and in Germany, where he met his wife, Helena. In 1936, the MGB appointed him resident director in Switzerland. Contrary to the term's definition, a resident never lived in the territory for which he was responsible. He would operate from a neighboring country, whose laws he was careful not to contravene. His agents did the actual espionage work in the country concerned. He alone was in possession of the prearranged codes and performed the transmission of news to the MGB in Moscow. Living in the shelter of Geneva, Alexander Radau's responsibility was Germany. Yet in 1939, shortly before the outbreak of the war, he had barely begun his work. He had received strict instructions to build up a large network before attempting any important operations and to protect it by means of the usual go-betweens. If possible, the sources of information should not be connected with the Communist Party. In the event of a catastrophe, such people should be disowned. On the other hand, the go-betweeners and the wireless operators, vital elements to any espionage organization, should belong to the party. If they were sufficiently well-conditioned, they would be capable, when captured, of committing suicide if there was a danger that they might be forced to talk. Finally, Moscow instructed Radau that his network must always be ready to produce information, but until the order to do so was received, he was to lie low and avoid the slightest suspicion. His front was excellent, the head of a respected cartographical firm, the Geopresse, specializing in the manufacture of globes and other maps required for the press and the general public. This decision to keep Radau's network in a state of watchful inactivity was in fact a tactical ruse. It was to serve as a reserve base that would operate only if absolutely necessary. At that time, the USSR had no shortage of espionage centers in Germany. About 20 resident directors, assisted by 300 agents, were dotted around the country. The wisdom of the NGB's decision to use Rado's network only as a last resort was to be demonstrated 2 years later, when the ABWAR and the SD were to wipe out almost to a man the mass of Russian spies operating on German territory. One after another, they were captured. A few of them went over to the German side. The rest were shot. But in 39, no one expected such a situation. Alexander Rado could take his time in establishing his network. In any case, a small Soviet cell was already operating from Switzerland against Germany. Since 1936, it had been directed by a woman known as Sonia. Her real name was Ursula Schultz. Like her husband Alfred, Sonia was German. She had joined the Communist Party with the same fervor with which others entered holy orders. To serve the cause was her only aim. For a long time, all went well with the Schultzes. They were spying together in China when the MGB purged its secret service of numerous suspected Trotskyites. The Swiss post fell vacant, and Ursula was sent to fill it. Shortly afterwards, Alfred Schultz, at a loss without his wife, was arrested in Shanghai and had to be in captivity ever since. Sonia was a tall, slim, attractive young woman of about 35. She was not unintelligent, but had lost something of her original faith. She had been deeply shaken by the German-Russian pact. How could these Soviet diplomats enjoy such a cordial relations with the Nazis in the open while the two countries were secretly locked in a ruthless struggle? She lived with her two children and a housekeeper in a large rented villa at Cox, C-A-U-X, a health resort overlooking Montreux. A monthly salary of 1,000 Swiss francs, about $230, enabled her to live in comfort. For some time, she had been showing signs of dangerous boredom. She'd even set up the long aerial of her transmitter receiver in her garden, while carelessly concealing the set itself in a biscuit tin in her dining room. She broadcast only once every 2 weeks and had only a few agents in Germany who supplied her at irregular intervals with very minor information. Radow was more active. Foresight had always been one of his virtues, and although he had not yet begun to operate, he had assembled by 1939 about 50 sources of intelligence, primarily on Germany, but also on other countries. Among them was a Lithuanian Jew by the name of Isaac, who also worked for the International Labor Office and who supplied information on the League of Nations. Isaac was doubled by a Frenchman, Brandt. May and Anna were concerned with the rearmament of Italy. Lily, on the Vatican, was a diplomat to the Holy See. Rado had thought that the Soviet government might one day be grateful for his knowledge of the official and unofficial positions of the Church. Rado's best source, until Rosler was taken on, was a certain very talented spy by the name of Otto Punter. Popko, as he was nicknamed, had set up his own small organization, which he called ROT, R-O-T. It operated in South Germany. It was composed of Germans hostile to Nazism. Incomparably less well-placed and also less effective than Rosler's friends, the members of the ROT occasionally supplied military intelligence but specialized in economic information. Otto Punter was a Swiss ex-journalist who had belonged to the Swiss Social Democratic Party. He had been fighting fascism for a long time. During the Spanish Civil War, he had been in Italy, supplying Spanish Republicans with intelligence concerning the transportation of arms by sea to General Franco. He had begun his espionage career on July 10, 1930, when he took part in the famous flight over Milan, conceived by the Italian Randolfo Picciardi, when thousands of anti-Mussolini tracks were dropped over the city. Such a past had attracted Alexander Rado. Having discovered the Punter's address in Switzerland through an indiscretion on the part of the Swiss Communist Party, Rado approached and hired him. The general secretary of the Swiss Party, Leon Nicole, and his son Pierre had helped Rado in the recruitment of his go-betweens. All were members of the party, as Moscow wished. Most of them, like Christian Schneider and Rachel Dubendorfer, worked for the International Labor Office. The Nicoles had introduced Radow to three agents in Geneva, Margarita Boley, an unmarried woman who lived at 8 Bis Rue, Henry Mussard, and Edmund and Olga Hamel, who lived at 192 Rue des Florissants. Margaret Boley and Edmund Hamel became the network's wireless operators. Radow saw a great deal of his agents, particularly the young and pretty Margarita, who became his mistress. But none of them knew where Radow lived. He always made several intricate detours before returning home to 113 Rue de Lausanne, the long road stretch from Gare de Gonaven in Geneva to Parmont Repos overlooking Lake Leman. This, then, was the situation in this powerful, inactive organization, which was suddenly galvanized by Rudolf Rosner. But before continuing the story, one last character must be introduced, one who was to become as important as Radow himself. Thanks to him, the center first began to take serious notice of Rosler. He was an Englishman named Alexander Foote. Foote's life had been a chaotic one. He seemed fated to become a secret agent. He belonged to that category of human beings who are perpetually unsatisfied. They love money, but abhor work. Possessed by a lust for power, they're paralyzed by timidity. They rage constantly at their own failure, but do nothing to escape it. The profession of espionage provides them with that escape, since it satisfies all their needs, and they choose it as soon as the opportunity arises. Foote did just this, without a moment's hesitation or reflection. He was born in 1905 into a comfortable middle-class family, was given a good education, but was incapable of benefiting from it. Failure seems to dog his footsteps from the beginning. In 2 years, he passed from being manager of a small business to being in charge of a garage, chief salesman in a shop, only to end up unemployed. Little more was needed to thrust him into the arms of the Communist Party. The Spanish Civil War had just begun, and there at last was a cause worth defending. In December 1936, Alexander Foote found himself near Madrid in the British battalion of the International Brigade. The political commissar of his unit, Douglas Springhall, soon noticed his intelligence, his meticulous sense of order, and his great manual dexterity. Springhill was to be his Pygmalion. He turned Foote into a spy. In September 1938, Foote managed to flee from the dying Spanish Republic at the wheel of a Red Cross truck, which he brought back with him to Britain. Though the influence of Springhall, he was invited to attend the British Communist Party conference in Birmingham. Foote had nothing to do at the conference and was thoroughly bored. In fact, this had been no more than an excuse to get him out of Spain. When Foote presented himself at party headquarters in King Street in London, some days later, a surprise awaited him. Instead of being returned to the front, he was offered a special post for which Douglas Springhill had warmly recommended him. It meant working for the Soviet Union as a secret agent in Europe. Springhill had not misjudged him. Foote accepted immediately and was sent directly to St. John's Wood, to the headquarters of the resident director in London. The initial formulation quickly performed, he was given his instructions. He was to go to Geneva. On October 10, 1938, he would be outside the General Post Office in the Rue du Mont Blanc, wearing a white scarf around his neck and holding a leather belt in his right hand. At noon, a woman would approach and ask if he had the time. In a string bag on her arm, there would be a green parcel, in her hand an orange. She would be his contact. The woman was none other than Sonia, the experienced Ursula Schultz. She was a little surprised by the choice of a recruit. This completely inexperienced Englishman would have a great deal to learn. She gave him 2,000 Swiss francs, about $450, and sent him to Munich, advised him to study German and act like a tourist, and keep his eyes and ears open. 3 months later, on January 10, 1939, Foote met Sonia again in front of the post office in Lausanne. She immediately noticed that the Englishman had considerably improved his German, and he was not a spendthrift, since the money had been sufficient for his needs, and more important, that he was a good listener. He had discovered that when in Munich, Hitler always lunched at the same restaurant, the Osteria Bavaria, near the Karlsplatz. Foote's imagination kindled, and he suggested that he organize an attempt on Hitler's life. Sonia cooled his ardor and told him to go on observing and learning. This time she sent him back to Munich with $900. He was not to return before May or June, and she would get in touch with him. One of her agents in Germany would visit him in April and give him more money. Foote recognized this agent on sight. He was one of his friends from the International Brigade, William Phillips, now engaged by the Russians to study the production of one of the factories of IG Farben Group at Frankfurt. In August 1939, Ursula Schultz urgently summoned her two British spies to VV. The center had warned her that war was about to break out, and as there would be no new work for them for the time being, they were to learn radio telegraphy. So Bill Phillips and Foote moved into the modest boarding house at Montreux. Every day they went up to Caux and practiced on Ursula's transmitter receiver. By January 1940, Foote had become competent enough to communicate with the center on Ursula's behalf, which suited her perfectly well. She felt more and more bored by her job and had suddenly fallen in love with William Phillips. 7 months later, in August 1940, the MGB posted Alexander Foote to Radau's headquarters in Geneva for a long enough to teach Margarita Boley and Edward Hamel how to use the transmitter receivers. Each of them had just been supplied with the latest models. Boley had hidden her set at her home in the Rue Henri Massard in the Yeovives district. Hamel had no difficulty in concealing his in his radio shop near the Par Alfred Bertrand. Hamel had previously studied radio engineering in Paris, yet curiously he was to prove the least gifted of the three as a Morse code operator. The center decided that Foote would act as a wireless operator. Radau would communicate all urgent intelligence to him. Hamel and Boley would deal with more non-time dispatches. Foote was not to remain in Geneva, but would go to Lucerne to avoid being rounded up by the Swiss authorities. His signal would be NDA and his call sign FRX, Sonia, and Phillips resigned from the service and in November 1940 was given permission to settle in Britain. On December 20th, they left for London via Lisbon. Meanwhile, Foote had found a flat at 20 Camille de Longue on the top floor of a large building. Any visitors would have to pass through two heavy, well-locked doors to get into the flat itself, thus providing Foote an entrance resembling a submarine's flooding chamber. He was delighted with this ideal strategic arrangement. If intruders broke into his retreat, he would have ample time while they forced the second door to sabotage his transmitter receiver set and destroy his files. And that's it for today. I want to tell you, I'm a great believer in low tech while everybody goes crazy over high tech. And it would behoove everybody that hears me that's on our side to learn Morse code and become very proficient at it, because Morse code is still very viable and works very well. And when I was a kid, I had a 10-watt transmitter. I had several transmitters. I was not even 16 yet, because I got my federal amateur license when I was 12. And this 10-watt little transmitter, I communicated with South Africa and Europe with a very long wire antenna. So with almost no money and a very small, powerful antenna or transmitter that would fit in a cigar box, you could have worldwide communications. And the time is coming, I think, when low-tech is going to come back into its own. So that's just my opinion. I could be wrong. 14:05, I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day.